Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Born in 1960 in Brooklyn, New York, Lorna Simpson earned her BFA in photography from the School of Visual Arts in New York in 1983 and her MFA from the University of California, San Diego in 1985. She first gained recognition in the mid-1980s for her large photograph and text works that confront and challenge conventional views of gender, identity, culture, history, and memory. With unidentified figures as a visual point of departure, Simpson uses the human form to examine the ways in which gender and culture shape the interactions, relationships, and experiences of contemporary American lives. On September 10, 2016, Simpson delivered the inaugural presentation of the Arnold Newman Lecture Series on Photography held at the National Gallery of Art. Her work is represented in the gallery's collection by Two Pairs, a photogravure published by graphic studio USF, and Untitled Two Necklines, two gelatin silver prints, and 11 engraved plastic plaques. Untitled Two Necklines is on view in the exhibition Intersections, photographs and videos from the National Gallery of Art and the Corcoran Gallery of Art through January 2, 2017.
To say, as a kind of introduction to who I am as an artist and how I think about what I do, is that I've had always, throughout my life, a very strong interest in photography and the kind of artistically, that was my starting point to a certain extent, although I was trained as a painter, as most foundation art school artists are, but quickly kind of gravitated towards photography, and now, many years later, found myself interested in painting again in ways that was very a kind of trepidatious and nervous entry back into that arena. Only because I know so many amazing, accomplished painters who are very close friends of mine for many years, that I feel embarrassed show them my work a little bit. But that I've gotten over that. So let's begin. I'll get my pointer. This is Water Bearer. And so I'm starting from work that is this light here, if someone can adjust that. Is an early piece of kind of just getting out of school and going to New York and actually trying to find work. And in trying to find work in New York and being fresh out of graduate school, the issue was like you contact your friends, like, what do you have going on? What are you doing? And I had met a woman named Kelly Jones, who is an art historian, a few years prior to that, at an internship at the Studio Museum. I was an intern in education there. And she said, oh, I'm starting to work for this museum that's a kind of private museum that this guy named Ed Broider is putting together, and we need a secretary. Why don't you come? So I did. I interviewed and with Joan Simon, who later, many years later, curated the show that you spoke about at the Jus de Paume. But I was just basically answering the phones. But it was in a little loft building that was in Soho, kind of which no longer exists. I mean, Soho has changed so much. But in the evenings, Kelly would give me her keys, and I would photograph inside this kind of loft building that was the offices. And is this where that piece is made. So in talking with Joan in the kind of curating of the show that was part of the Jus de Paume in the Haus de Kunst, I told her that story. Like, she had no idea that I was kind of taking over the office every evening. But Water Bearer is about memory and kind of, in a lot of the work, there is this specter of how we interpret the world we live in or ourselves by the memories we have and those memories being discounted or ignored. So for me, that's a kind of important theme that runs throughout the work. She saw him disappear by the river. They asked her to tell what happened, only to discount her memories. So these kind of either collective or singular memories that are dismissed or not engaged. So in that, the kind of work begins like getting out of graduate school as this kind of signature work. Okay, I have to ask for this to go out because it's just blinding me. 20 Questions, a sampler, is this kind of format of work where I decided not to have the figure kind of presented. So it's kind of sparing down the information in the frame in terms of who and what and kind of what you can make of facial details or how you can surmise who I am talking about in it, but not to give a monolithic idea of who is pictured, meaning like this isn't about kind of all black women or all black people, but more how we kind of interrogate photographs in terms of portraiture. So kind of not giving the viewer all the information that they want in terms of these very precious kind of details that are usually present in photographic portraits. And then delivering something else, of bringing your attention to something else. And that strategy or that effort came out of showing a lot of different kind of, I went to undergraduate school as a photographer predominantly and kind of traveled all over Europe, United States and North Africa, just photographing while I was in college. College was much cheaper than it is now, so I would take the max student loan, which is like nothing now, pay off my tuition, and then use the rest of the money to travel. And that's kind of how I rotated that throughout every other year. But in doing so, and kind of before I got out of college, beginning to be invited to participate in shows, I would participate in shows, but then after a while, I kind of felt these kind of documentary street photography shows, all the work is kind of presented in the same way, and the way that the viewer walks through the exhibition is kind of with the same tools of reading one image from the other, and kind of with the same assumptions about the photographer's intentions, about who is pictured in the frame. So I wanted to create some other kind of dialogue between the viewer and myself about what they're looking at and why they ask certain kinds of questions or make certain kinds of assumptions. And this is untitled 1989, that is here in the museum. And so it became these works that are very sparse, studio setup, images of different friends of mine. One is of Alva Rogers, this is of Diane, another friend of mine, which we would trade. Either I would pay them or we'd trade in images. I would give them portraits of themselves as payment. But in this text is kind of like a listing of things, or kind of maybe very close to what would be a concrete poem. So rings, surround, lasso, noose, eye, areola, halo, cuffs, collar, loop, feel the ground sliding from under you, a kind of vulnerability in terms of one's condition. And what would that mean kind of in a private sense or in a public sense? And so therefore, given the kind of climate that we've been living in for the past few years here, either in terms of police brutality or gun violence, I feel that it's a piece that is probably speaks very clearly to that in many ways. This is Stereo Styles, 1988, and is a series of Polaroid images. And I work at the Polaroid Corporation 20 by 24 Polaroid studio that are very kind of extra, extra large Polaroids that come out of a giant camera instantly, which is exhilarating. I haven't worked in there for a while, but it was an exhilarating process to kind of have these giant Polaroids that you pull out of a camera. And this in Stereo Styles, and for this period of work, there was a lot of work that I did around women and kind of the cliches or stereotypes about their behavior, the way that they look, the way that they act, the way that they speak, and kind of the way kind of societal demands in terms of constricting those personalities or trying to label them. So the text is pulled from a magazine copy, which is, which way can I read it better? This way. Daring, sensible, severe, long and silky, boyish, ageless, silly, magnetic, country fresh and sweet, which is just all perfume and body odor ads, or hair dye ads text. But in a way to start to unravel the language in which we use to describe women or to describe gender for that matter. So there comes a point in my work, and this is like Wiggs, 1994 to 2006. But in 1994, and by this time, I had had a project room at the Museum of Modern Art and a show, a big survey show at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago. And I was quite young, and what was surprising to me as a young artist, which you would think, like, you're walking into a nice, big, major institutions and seeing your work presented to you that maybe you've done over the past 7 to 10 years. And I was shocked that I kind of turned my back on my own work. I was like, okay, I'm done doing that. I've seen every, like, the show kind of showed me every avenue that I had gone down, every kind of iteration of a thought, of a process, of an idea, in a way. And it was shocking to me that I just wanted to walk away from it all and begin again, to kind of invent again and renew what I was doing, my relationship to my work. Which is kind of shocking, but now that I've done it a few times, I realize that kind of is what happens. You do big shows, and it really does propel you into another way of working, because the time and energy that it takes for a traveling show, and the shepherding and ideas and writing and editing of books and images, etc., that goes into it, really does make you re-examine what you're doing and the level of conversation that you're having with either directors of museums or the curators of the exhibition are quite intense. And I think that forces you to then think about new things. So this particular work, Wiggs 2, which there's another one called Wiggs, but this one will suffice, was my effort at saying, okay, no more figure, no more strategy of having the camera and a woman's back turned, to use a surrogate and completely drop or forbid myself from using other elements that I had used in the past. So I went to Fulton Mall. I live in Brooklyn. If any of you have been to Brooklyn and know Fulton Mall, which has changed now, but to a certain extent, there are 90 million wig shops and hair extension shops. And at that time, they were kind of all next door. Like, it was just one right after the other. So I kind of just went to all these different shops and found as many different kind of hair pieces, wigs, that I could possibly find in an effort to kind of build this kind of template of personalities based on these fanciful hairdos that are wigs. But also to then examine the kind of construction of femininity through this idea of the way one wears their hair, the way one adorns themselves. So that would then be then the construction of not only gender, but also sexuality. So embedded in this piece are different stories about choices being made and decisions about constructing one's identity based on gender and sexuality. And this particular little part here on the side has an interviewer with a mother who is very concerned about the way her child is fascinated, her male child is, male-identified child is, fascinated with the stockings on a mannequin and wants to try them on. And when they're in department stores, he's completely beside himself. And it turns from the interviewer, kind of psychologist, actually trying to get the mother to kind of re-examine how she is thinking about gender, and not so much the child and what the child needs, but what she needs in terms of expanding or broadening her perspective. It's a detail. The wig produced a desired effect. So the piece, I'll go back for a second. So the piece to me, it also has another text about Kraft and his wife, who are to escape slaves. The woman is very light-skinned. Her husband is dark, or lover is dark-skinned. You know, you really in slavery, unless it's a private ceremony of in recognition of being married. But in their escape, she pretends to be an elderly white slave owner, and he pretends to be her slave, and that's how they make their escape until they almost get confronted in New York because she cannot read a document that they're demanding that she read, and she kind of just arrogantly says, "How dare you? I'm on my deathbed, and you're asking me to read something," and they kind of, her arrogance kind of saves her, or saves them. Of pretending to kind of be white and arrogant in the request to read something. So that too is this kind of switch and out of different sorts of circumstances in and around the construction of identity, but certainly one that is part of our history in terms of the way that gender and sexuality gets constructed. So in my, it's 1995, in my desire to, I'm going to do new things, work with different kind of people, stuff I've never done before, I'm not going back to doing the figures, I get an invitation to go to Pilcheck, which is crazy land for pyromaniacs. But I didn't know that, right? So you get there and they go, you know, you have the best, you know, Dale Chihuly's first person who is the greatest gaffer on the planet is going to be working with you. And, you know, basically as an artist who doesn't really, I don't really do sculpture, I wouldn't say never, but that's not really what I do right now or then. But it really was like watching crazy people with, you know, hollowing out logs and pouring molten glass in it. And then everybody's got, you know, men and women barely clad in front of the glory holes and all this fire and all this heat. And it's just so entertaining, as a layperson to just watch. You go, oh, I'm here to make art? What was I making again? And just be completely absorbed by kind of this primal thing of watching fire and bodies. But then after about a week, I kind of pulled myself together and I said, okay, I really, because I was coming, you know, when you're in New York and you're in a studio, you know, like, oh, I want to do these glass pieces that have text engraved on them, and then maybe they're on this armature that they vibrate. And when I explained that to them, they were like, why did you come all the way here to do that, which you could do etching in New York, you know, in your studio by yourself? And they're like, but we can make, you know, hands for you, we can make a whole body. And I was like, okay, guys, you know, I'm not doing that. So I went into, I got a car to drive me an hour and a half into Seattle to go to a bookstore to find a book that I had on my shelf in Brooklyn that was by Deborah Willis, titled James Van Der Zee. And in flipping through that, started to look with a different set of eyes at his portraits. And came back to the, got back to the ranch and said, okay, here's what I want to do. I want you to do these vases. And again, they were looking at me like, really? Vases? But I said, okay, black glass. I want you to take from these images the props that appear in these photographs and redo them in black glass. So it was really an interesting way to kind of approach my, of course, you know, in-depth sense of and history of photography and being familiar with James Van Der Zee's work, but also giving me the opportunity, because the text that appears beneath each one is my descriptive text of the image itself. So this is a image of a trans woman seated, and I think there's like a telephone, but there's this gorgeous vase that then gets reproduced. And I then re-describe the image, and then really what ends up is just this picture of the vase. Now, of course, when you're in Pilcheck and you're making all this stuff, they don't tell you until 2 days before you leave, you gotta pack it up. And so like thousands of dollars later, to my surprise, how to protect and cut out, what do you call that? A turkey cutter to get foam to cut out the spaces so that you could put it in these giant boxes so it doesn't get broken. But then got all of that back to New York only to set it on the table in my studio and re-photograph it. And that's kind of how the piece exists. But it was an interesting process intellectually to try to figure out how to work in these different ways or different kinds of collaborations and make a piece out of it. So this is Beau of the Ball. This is painter Benny Andrews in the kind of chrysanthemum tear-shaped vase that's next to him, and my description of his coat and how he's dressed and seated and of the image. Reclining nude, and that's the vase that's upside down in that image. Working in felt, and those pieces are also printed on felt. Felt was another way to kind of get away from this framed photographic image that you go to, you take photographs, you make edits, you send it to the lab, you get them mounted, then you get them framed, and then that's it. And just the repetition of that for me over the years, I wanted to do something different, and I kind of through, I'm going to forget the name of it now, but in Philadelphia, that'll come back to me. The thing of working on felt really came from spending time in Paris and seeing a Joseph Beuys show, kind of maybe 10 years or so before that. And of course, Beuys' use of felt is amazing and deafening and quieting to a room. It has all these different kind of auditory and physical effects that take place when either stacks or cloaked pianos, etc., or felt suit. So I was a little nervous about like, oh, I'm going to be printing on felt, but it, you know, as time has gone by, it's a completely different thing. But they do look like drawings because they're silk screened and they have this kind of blurred effect upon close proximity, but once you kind of move back, the image kind of comes together. But the segmenting and each panel is printed individually and then it kind of comprises of an entire image is the kind of format that starts to infiltrate the work kind of to even up till today. So each one, it was from a series of kind of traveling, how can I put this, let me start again. In traveling around and doing all these different kinds of shows as an artist, and particularly in the 90s, I would take, I kind of bought myself a Hasselblad camera, and this is kind of before, of course, iPhones. I never carry that camera anymore. I have no use for it now. My iPhone does everything to a certain extent. But at that time, to force myself to take pictures, I would carry a very heavy Hasselblad camera through customs because in carrying it, then I would say, okay, now you brought all this stuff, and every time you go to customs, you're protecting the film, you have to take pictures. So while traveling once through the Southwest, I was trying to think of an idea for a show and reading this book by Pat Calafia about public sex. And it's kind of this anecdotal, historical, kind of funny, and but quite with a sociological bent about how people or society chooses kind of these public areas to have sex, which they've done for centuries. And in the modern world that we live in, it takes place kind of, you know, the landscape of sex and kind of where people have sex changes from day to night. So parks become different places in certain areas after certain hours. Business offices become that. Museum, staircases, you know, if you don't get caught. All kinds of things. I'm sure everyone here has either done it or you've caught someone in the act of doing it. So it wasn't so much that the kind of sexual encounters themselves were important to me, but kind of the way that we think about public space and the way that we think about the body. And kind of the way those environments kind of shift and change. So to go back, I guess, for a second, this is about people having sex in the car and kind of their conversation, but the kind of echo within this kind of vaulted ceiling that's kind of somewhere in northern Italy, the kind of sounds that kind of are created. And so from all these different travels and kind of reading Pat Calafia's book and having my own archive of all these pictures from all this travel, which were unpopulated images, I kind of said to myself, oh my God, I could use those images for this project. And so there was nothing more satisfying than kind of going through old negatives of things that I had taken years before and kind of looking at them for use within this kind of subject matter and kind of using an archive that had no purpose suddenly became purposeful. And so there's a whole body of work that is the public sex series. But also, and I just want to run ahead so that I can see, okay. So in the public sense, this is called Cloud, and kind of this gives you a sense of the scale of them. They are kind of quite large. And this is part of the Haus der Kunst in Munich. The clock tower, which for me reminded me very much of a piece by Felix Gonzalez Torres that has two clocks that are synchronized. But in mine, and this is kind of really an ode to Felix, but also the same thing about an office building and kind of different floors are under construction and during construction or after hours, rendezvous between people and kind of the effort to set that up of what areas, where to meet after work. in a secluded area in a building. So now I want to switch to some of the video projects, but before you play that, Olivia, before we go there. So in undergraduate school, I was really fascinated by film and kind of took film history courses. And I think for the photographic work that I did later in graduate school and kind of throughout, I think the kind of structurally or conceptually, film had a lot to do with the way that I was thinking about photography. So while in graduate school, I said, this is the perfect opportunity. UCSD has great facilities. But let's remember, it was during analog, and that drove me crazy. After about 2 weeks of courses in video editing in analog, I gave up. I just said, I'm going to be the kind of artist that if I'm going to make something in video, I'm going to hire people to do it because this is driving me crazy. You make one mistake, and then you're all the way back to the beginning again. So by the time I kind of got reinterested or had an opportunity through the Wexner Center, of course, Avid had been invented, and it was like a beautiful world of digital ways of working digitally, that there was none of this working on a Steinbeck or shooting in film and or analog video. And kind of dived right in, which was kind of, which this isn't the first project that I did, but certainly I remember the first, I was pregnant, and, no, was I pregnant? No, I wasn't pregnant. That's the second project I was pregnant. No, because I remember I got really drunk, so I couldn't have been the first. After the first day of shooting, I got really drunk, so I couldn't have been pregnant, A. B, I woke up at 1 o'clock in the morning thinking it was the call time that was 6 o'clock and saying, okay, are we all ready to go? And everyone was like, my girlfriend of mine that was rooming in the same room with me who was doing costume just said, it is 1 o'clock in the morning. We're not there yet. So working in video and film is like a drug. I mean, the aspect of its collaborative nature and the way that you're in conversation with other people, decisions are made instantly, or you can kind of throw in things off the top of your head to a certain extent and work with a storyboard or a script. It's like, I love it. There's nothing more fascinating than me. And you get to tell everybody what to do, and everybody's effort is to help you do what you want to do. I mean, like, that just is blowing my mind. But this work is called Easy to Remember. And was a piece that's based on John Coltrane's, out of his album, I'm trying to think of it, based on the album, which is Ballads, and it's a Rodgers and Hart tune called Easy to Remember. So we had, this is shot at the Wexner, but not part of a Wexner project. And we invited like 12 people to audition, and everybody who auditioned we used, and because they were all professional singers, and had them hum, listening to John Coltrane's rendition of Easy to Remember, which, and then the melody kind of takes all these different levels than the kind of more traditional composition of the song. But in doing that, there was one woman who was humming, and it is, if you're not used to working or being an actor in front of a camera, I think sometimes people forget, like, yeah, there's a camera very near you, and then there's 10 people watching you, that there's a whole series of things. It's not an intimate experience at all. So one of the women that we were photographing, the sound guy kept, and we were in a sound stage, and he kept saying to me, okay, we need to stop. And I thought, okay, maybe he has the headphones on, he can hear whether there's an ice cream truck or a garbage truck backing up or something else in the background that we need to then start again. But then this time he kind of walks over to me, and I'm like, oh my God, don't tell me that the DAP machine has crashed and that, like, we're going to have to take off time to find another thing. And he just walked over and said, you know, her heartbeat is louder than her humming. So he said, okay, let's all take a break. Let's just chat. Let's have some water and try to get her, like, to calm her nerves. But I thought that in and of itself was a piece in terms of humming and heartbeat and kind of the condition of the body in order to perform like that. That didn't get into the piece, but was always something to me that was a separate thing that maybe at some point I will do something with. So it was making these work, easy to remember, is about making this piece that has to do with the body and kind of humming, being away, rather than singing or different kinds of melodies, using the body as a melody itself, using the throat. Okay, so now I'm ready to play Easy to Remember, Olivia. Raise the level just a little bit, Olivia. So that's, let's see, Easy to Remember. The next piece that I did archive, yeah, I guess 2003, is Corridor. And it was a collaboration with Wageshi Mutu, who is a artist, installation artist, painter, artist. And in making that piece, it was with Mass MoCA, and they had this project of working with, they wanted, I mean, maybe 10 different artists, because they have a huge space in Massachusetts, and each artist got kind of 2,000 square feet to work with artifacts from the NSPC, the New England's a kind of Antiquities, Society for Antiquities, I can't quite remember its exact name, but basically, when I got out of graduate school, I worked in New York for the New York Historical Society in their warehouses in January in Yonkers. And that experience was kind of fascinating because you had cannonballs, you had dishware, you had photo, you know, old glass photographs, all these kind of things that people will donate that are part of Americana, particularly within the New York area. But in January, in unheated warehouses, you know, you lose your fucking mind. You really, you know, we started by, like, would they really miss that cannonball? I mean, really? Nobody's coming back up here but us, you know. With really interesting people, other artists and conservators, interesting experience, one which I was happy to have it come to its end. Just because of the temperatures and the cold and, you know, trying to stay warm and stay engaged. But then walking through the warehouses in Massachusetts for SBNEA is the name of the organization, I had a flashback and it wasn't good. I was just like, I can't do this. I am not going to, I can't fill a space 2,000 square feet and kind of have the patience to walk through all this lovely New England antiquity that's on shelves, much like at the New York Historical Society in Yonkers. So I kind of gave up on the project, and I kind of very politely called them one day and said, you know, I don't think I'm the right person for the show. I really don't have much interest. They go like, but please look at the book again. So I'm sitting on the phone looking at the book, and I come across this house called the Coffin House. And it's a kind of really, I think, late 1600s house that kind of, you know, rebuilt, added on this and that over the course. So it looks like 1760s, but it really isn't. It's a little older than that. And then I come across a picture of a Walter Gropius home on Walden Pond, which is his own personal residence that's also part of their collection. And in the middle of conversation, I said, so can I use the architecture? And of course, you know, then they get all this pullback. Well, I don't know. I mean, what do you want to use it for? I said, no, maybe just shoot a film. They're like, ooh, really, film? I mean, they're historical houses. I mean, we could, you know. So I said, that's fine. Don't let me, you know, just think about it. And they came back after much negotiation of like of just trying to ensure them that we wouldn't tear the houses up. They let me do this project. Because I live in a house in Brooklyn that is 1860s. And I, you know, in New York and kind of brownstone Brooklyn, everybody has this fantasy about Victorian era. So even though many of the houses aren't, people will decorate and kind of redo them to Victorian era to no end. So to find a place, but part of that neighborhood is also part of the Underground Railroad. So, but to find a kind of architectural, someone's basement that hasn't been redone that's kind of within the same, you know, era is almost close to impossible. So I always had this idea of me being this African-American woman living in a house that I bought in like 1988 that's from 1860-something. I don't know, records burned. Fire, Brooklyn Building Department, so there isn't an exact date for the house. But I always thought about this duality, and like the church a couple of blocks away from my house is also from the Underground Railroad. And I thought that would be an interesting piece. So therefore, in this opportunity, I said, hey, here's the idea for that piece. I could actually make this work. The Coffin House looks 1860s, and Walter Gropius' house, although I think is built in 49, the decor is from like 1969 or 1965. So I do the project, and at that time, like right before it, I kind of, Wageshi Mutu is working for me as actually an archivist because I'm finishing up kind of just all the information on my work or my career in terms of exhibition histories and publications for Fiden book, and she's helped kind of archiving that information and getting it together for Fiden. And she's from Kenya and was kind of by way of London, and her visa was running out, and she was trying to figure out if she was going to stay in New York or kind of leave the country and then come back. And I just said, well, in the interim, while you have the last couple of weeks, why don't you be the protagonist in this project, because I don't know, for some reason none of my other friends were available. It kind of works that way. I kind of go through, okay, list of friends first, check mark. And she agreed. And what's interesting of working with her, you know, it's for me, I find, and I have a daughter who acts, I think actors are like amazing people. They're kind of these animals that just turn into something else. In when they come into character. And Wageshi is an artist and performer, but also part of this in kind of talking to her while we were on set, actually, and not even before, that she has an amazing singing voice and performs and has this whole, and as part of her childhood or kind of coming up, performance is very kind of an activity that she studied. So her performance in it is quite beautiful for that reason, I believe. And so it's a woman from the 1860s and a woman from the 1960s, kind of the moment of emancipation and kind of the complexity of what that means, because being free isn't really that free at that time, but also a woman in the 1960s in a house, that kind of black woman in a modernist house, and the complexity of her life. And what in those two periods of time, in terms of history, kind of what would say civil rights era and also the era of emancipation, what might be going on in their minds. So if we could play Olivia Corridor. Oh, wait a minute, one more thing. And sorry, I just forgot, I should say that. So the other part of this is that the soundtrack is in two parts. One part is Blind Tom, who is this composer from the 1860s as well, who was enslaved and, you know, quoted as being an idiot savant because, of course, you know, intelligence could not possibly be part of who he is as a man at that particular moment in the description from that time. But an amazing proclivity to being able to play music by ear instantly, and also to compose. So he has all these amazing compositions of kind of Americana music, from Dixie to Star Spangled Banner, I mean, all this different music, but it's written in a completely different way that has a very dark tone to it. That is paired with Albert Eiler's Love Child, which is a kind of jazz, concrete jazz musician, 60s. And there's for me personally, I'm not a musicologist, but a huge similarity in the way that they approach American music in that way, early American music. And I see similarities in their compositions. So those two tracks are played against one another. Okay, now I'm done. So Blind Tom is played by a woman named Nurit Tillis, and the Albert Eiler tracks are direct tracks. So if we could freeze frame there, Olivia. I don't have time to play the whole thing, I'm sorry. But what's fascinating to me, I mean, even in terms of the architecture of the Walter Gropius home, is how intimate it is. So, you know, you think, yeah, Walter Gropius, you know, Walden Pond, it's really beautiful. And then you walk into the bedroom, and there's like a glass wall with a mirror in it. So there's this whole voyeurism into the bedroom thing that's going on, like a two-way, one can be watched and observed and performed. The bedroom is a performance space. And that kind of gave me some insight into Mr. Gropius. That was quite fascinating. His bedroom is fascinating. But also that then these two figures kind of go through their day on this day-to-day level of moment-to-moment, one being maybe runaway slave or indentured servant or in hiding somewhere in Massachusetts. And the other, I mean, this could be a home in Chicago of, you know, upper middle class black music industry, you know, Johnson Johnson Publishing. I mean, there's kind of a lot of that, and my part of my mother's side of the family is from Chicago. So the kind of duality of these two images and the way that this piece works, and just in a way of like, I think it's my, the film that stands out in my mind that probably I did have in my mind when I did this was Jean Dielman by Chantal Ackerman, which is a kind of very, 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 very elongated moment to moment of this woman and the kind of collapse of her world in a way, of a secret that's hidden, that inspired this kind of, they don't say anything, it's just you watch them in their the minutiae of their day to day. So these are kind of stills of how it kind of goes, translates to the day, and the woman in the Gropius home is like on the telephone talking and having conversations as if she is setting up a dinner that never takes place. And the other woman kind of goes and retreats into her room to kind of write, which at that time is, you know, the kiss of death if you're caught writing and reading. So I'm going to skip Cloudscape just for the sake of time and kind of go through. So in this thing of pointing to history and pointing to archives, I was also fascinated with photo booths, images, and always have collected these kinds of images either in flea markets or thrift shops or online and started to then really collect them. And in that, photo booths become this record of self-portraiture from, you know, not so much, yes, now, and like there are still photo booths where you can find them for like, you know, for $5 or so to make your own photographs, but a really amazing record of people taking pictures for themselves, either for identification purposes or to put into letters to show how you're doing in this kind of world of migration from one place to another, or leaving one place and arriving to another as a kind of testament to achieving your aspirations. And so they're combined in very teeny, small bronze frames, and then there are these blanks as if they're surrogates for other images that are missing. And they're paired either with just photography or drawings of mine or ink works. So this is another piece, 1957 to 2009, which came out of looking for online all these small little photo booth images. And in doing so, I found not this particular image, but an image of this woman who is unidentified. And it's a picture of her leaning up against a car from this year, like 1950, like a Studebaker. And I look at it and I go, that's amazing. So I buy the image, and then the seller writes me back and says, oh, I have this album, there's about 250 images of her, and they kind of look like this, are you interested? And I said, absolutely, and I purchased them. And to my surprise, it was exactly that. It wasn't a family album, it's this kind of project of hers and another and a man of photographs of them taken over the course of 3 months in 1957 in Los Angeles. Because, you know, like those little teeny kind of photographs have that abbreviated information written on them. And so I put them up very gingerly in my studio up on the wall, and I was just like, oh my God, this is a piece within itself. I mean, like, it's performing for the camera, it's figuring out how to pose for the camera. I mean, much as we do as you see selfies every day now with the way people pose. But definitely for the purpose of maybe being for pinup photography or for a career as an actor or an actress, it seems to be the purpose of these images. So I thought that this project was amazing and that there wasn't something to do to it, but maybe to add to it, to maybe expand it. And in its expansion, to talk about that these are constructions, that I really don't know who she is. I really don't know what her intention was or what her personal life was, but that by inserting myself into the frame, in some ways, it heightens the sense of this idea of the construction. So for about a month or 2 months in the summer of 2009, I got my daughter to help me photograph it, which was a nightmare because I don't like being in front of the camera. So from the very start, I'm evil. I'm like, I got an attitude. But also her body is different than mine in that she has longer, I think she's maybe taller than I am, but she's also double jointed and she has longer limbs. So getting into the positions that her body is in is almost like, you know, it's like a yoga position thing. Like, really? More? My body doesn't do that. So got through taking those photographs, and as it was ending, I was kind of getting used to it. Like, I was not so mean in the morning, or my daughter would, I would say, okay, you helping me, and then she would be off with a wig somewhere in the mirror, somewhere else in the house or wherever we were, like in her own world. But it was interesting to be destabilized like that as an artist, to feel completely uncomfortable in the work that I was making, but knew that it would be interesting if I could just get myself through it. So this is another individual that appears in this cameo of images that was part of that those albums. And he is really kind of, she's like the muse and he is like the artist. So he's the photographer, quote unquote. He's not really the photographer because the photographer is taking pictures of both of them. So he's not really the photographer, but he poses as a photographer and poses as an artist because in some of the pictures there's kind of a cubist painting behind him. You know, he's the thinker, he's playing chess, he's not engaged with the camera directly. And I just find this kind of, there's a kind of insinuation that they're a couple, but then who knows if they're a couple? I mean, because this is a thing, a construction for the camera. So in inserting myself, when this, I'm just kind of, like, there's hundreds of these now, which, okay, I don't have any of me. That's interesting, I don't have any me. Well, I'm in there. And what's interesting, I don't have any close-ups of that, but what's interesting is that you can't really tell that it's me. I mean, I put on a wig, I used to collect, because I have so many friends who are into fashion and kind of doing costume for film, we would just go to thrift shops and buy interesting costumes just because they were interesting, as if we had some room for some like collecting of, you know, fab fashion eras. Approximating what she had on was quite easy, either through shopping now or kind of this small collection of clothing that I already had. And then posing, but like it's very subtle how it goes back and forth, because I even go to in upstate New York, there's some cornfields, she's in a cornfield, I'm in a cornfield. She's got a straw hat, I got a straw hat. You know, like I was able to kind of like, I got it. We can kind of correlate this in a way that it seems almost seamless. And working on it and kind of, it comes to a point with that, let me go back. This image, the images of them playing chess. So I do this piece, it's about 300 some odd images. It's shown at Brooklyn Museum. I'm really loving the way that it looks. It's really an interesting piece, but I feel like I'm not really done. But I felt like I'm kind of done with me being in it, but there was something else I wanted to achieve from it as a video piece. And there's nothing more boring, and everybody states it, if you just look up chess in film, everyone will say, do not shoot a sequence of anybody playing chess in film, not unless they're doing a lot of talking over the action. And I decide, I'm just gonna have people on film playing chess. And these two characters playing against themselves. And in some ways, it kind of becomes this trick photography. It takes me back to the kind of turn of the century, advent of the invention of photography, and this is kind of one of my, out of my collection of photography of this young woman who's taking a picture of herself. And every time, like with different curators, of which just even casually in conversation with friends and curators, of like, well, what do you, you know, because people in New York, you know, you could, I had a show a couple of days ago, I'm telling you, people say to me, so what else are you working on? What's your next thing? You know, so there's always this pressure to talk about what you're doing next, even though you just finished a whole body of work, what are you doing next? So in working on this, you know, I was like, well, I'm working on this video piece, and everyone would bring up to me Duchamp and Picabia's five-way portrait, which is amazing, which is very similar to this image. And every time they would bring it up, I would go, yeah, I know, it's a five-way image with Duchamp. I got it. No, I'm not using that format. And then one woman who's, I'm sorry, her name, curator, that I was in conversation with said, have you been to MoMA? Because there was this artist who kind of did something with their, did a whole installation of their collection. This is a collection now at the Museum of Modern Art. And she showed me this on her phone. And I was like, okay, I give up. Now it's a black man, other than Duchamp and Picabia, by the same photographer in New York in 1916. So I go, okay, I give up. I'm going to do that. I'm just, it keeps coming up. Everybody keeps mentioning it. Now it's a black man in it. I got to do it. And so this is another thing of the trick photography and what makes it kind of destabilizing or that it seems like five different individuals is because the mirror that the sitter or the person who's posing is in front of is at a kind of 70 degree angle or something, or 45 degree angle, I can't remember. And therefore, the reflection kind of gives these different aspects of the face. It's not symmetrical. It's not like Hitchcock's. You know, you go back into infinity in this very symmetrical way. It's this kind of beautiful, slightly different view of the portrait. So we start putting that together. And I then have friends, of course, who do hair and makeup for film and costume. And they dress me. I find a jacket just like the guy with the chest. And I get like a hair piece. And my makeup and face is done very much to look like him. So the hair person, which is Idris Nichols, who's a very close friend of mine, and this other woman who's doing kind of prosthetic and makeup on me, are like my father's from Jamaica and Cuba. They're from Jamaica, and we're talking. And when they're done, I look in the mirror. They go, okay. I want you to look in the mirror. Just check it out. I check it out and go, oh my God, I look like my father. So I pull out, who died maybe like 10 years before that. So I pull out this giant photograph of my father that was from his memorials. And I don't have that out in the studio. It's tucked away somewhere. But it's giant. And I pull it out, and they have a heart attack. You're like, okay, now you're going to conjure your father, and now this is all going to go crazy. So put the photograph away. We get it. You're conjuring your dad right now, but like, you know, he's not alive, so that's a whole nother energy. Let's just... It was very funny, but I really looked like my... It was, like, even shocking to me. I was like, ooh, this is a deep piece. Okay, I look like my dad. So that's me in the still as the male character playing chess. And I had a chess wrangler. And so what seems like I'm playing chess is actually because my father tried to teach me chess, and I could never get it. Like, I was just like... I don't get it. You know, you would try really hard. It's like a great game for your mind. It's very interesting. It's about strategy. And I'm just like, I can't get past the pieces. What's that piece again? So I had someone calling out the pieces to me to move them. And I had to like study, okay, this is a pawn. This is a king. And so the thoughtfulness is just like, okay, king five, okay. To walk me through. So it is actually... a chess, a game where the female character wins, has chess, what do you call it, checkmate. But I kind of slowly have to be walked through it, which was kind of interesting. And that's me, it's like this combination, like it starts out very 50s and then ends up in this kind of Tina Turner kind of character kind of way. So I guess just to... the last note on that was that I also then, this was a collaboration with Jason Moran, who is a pianist and composer. And so in asking him that, I said, there's all this mirroring going on. You know, I'm mirroring my dad, I'm mirroring these two characters. The male and female components mirror one another. So I'd like for you to do some kind of composition that has to do with mirroring and something about the way that it's either played as a piece on the piano or kind of in its sound. So what happens is this, and so I'll try to play this out because it's architecturally, the way the piece is installed is kind of impossible to show it as a linear video, but here's an excerpt. So it's a three-part projection. So the characters age over the course of the game as well. They kind of go through the slow aging process, which this is kind of sped up. But so that's kind of the breadth of my work up to a certain point. But that all these different areas, I mean, I didn't get to the kind of collage and painting stuff, but there's all these different areas that I go down into. Roads I go down in terms of the work. And it's a career, and as a way of working, it's been really enriching to kind of explore maybe some of the same ideas in all these different mediums. But the kind of level of collaboration and or the demands of each medium has made it an interesting process. So I am happy to briefly answer any questions, because I know that there's another event that is going on here in this space coming up. Yes?
You mentioned at the beginning your affinity for photography.
Yes.
I'm curious, especially with some of the earlier work, The Vases, for example, why you chose to photograph them again instead of maybe something like The Vases as a sculptural object?
Say that part again, with the faces in the absence of the face?
The vases.
Oh, the okay, sorry.
The vases.
Sorry. I thought you said faces, I'm sorry.
The vases.
Yeah.
The vases. I'm just curious about what your sort of mind process was in terms of choosing to photograph them and
the actual object. Because I felt that James Van Der Zee is a photographer, and kind of as an homage to him, in some ways, it wasn't about the objects themselves. It's kind of about stripping down the image, the photographic image, to this one element, which is the prop. So kind of returning it to the medium of photography, which was very elaborate, and all, you know, going from the wet upper, like Washington State, all the way back, or Seattle, all the way back over to New York. It was kind of this long and interesting process to get to that, but certainly was one that it seemed appropriate, kind of conceptually, that it remain within a kind of photographic medium. Thank you. Yes.
Are the pieces that you showed us were all filmed? Were you shooting a film, or is there anything?
Actually, Cloudscape was shot in film, but for the sake of trying to transfer it then to video, that was a nightmare, just kind of digitally. And at that time, like, HD was just kind of, sort of getting its footing. So I ended up reshooting it a year later in high definition, and then from that point on, everything shot in video in high definition. Because just the process of transferring isn't worth it, isn't worth the effort, in a way. Yes?
What's in the New York show?
Paintings. So they're kind of segmented gesso, like engineered boards, are kind of gesso panels that are silk screened. So they are somewhat comprised, a little bit like the felt works. But I've been working on it with collage and painting now for like about 5 years. So they're then kind of painted with inks. As over the surface of these kind of silk-screened images. Yeah, this is a completely, completely different turn. But they are reminiscent of the felt works in a certain way. Yes?
With your collaborations with different artists,
with other artists' work? No. And then one that I left out, I mean, Cloudscape, which, forgive me, is with late Terry Atkins, who was an artist, musician, and composer, and Lone Wolf group. So, no, I haven't. I mean, I've been asked, you know, not really. I mean, I just did a collaboration with Common and doing a bunch of his singles and record albums, but not. That's a kind of different thing, but it was good because sometimes, you know, working with artists from completely different kinds of arenas, sometimes they go, you know, your work is really great, but could you do this? And you go, no, because I don't do that. but glad you asked me to do something that I don't do. But in that particular, and that kind of actually happened the same time I was working on my show, that was actually fun and kind of an interesting way where there was enough respect for what I do to kind of make something or make images that had to do with songs that worked. So yeah, I would say that's the last collaboration that I've done that I was asked to participate in, yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.